May it please the court, I'm James Ray Cottrell. I'm accompanied today by John Kelsey Cottrell and Amy Wells Spain. We are counsel for Deborah McDougall in this domestic relations case that involves several assignments of error relating both to the validity of the party's marriage in this case, which was held to be voidable by the Court of Appeals, held to be void ab initio by the trial court here, and also with respect to numerous other issues relating to an agreement between the parties, which we contend is nevertheless enforceable between them. I'd like to begin with our first assignment of error, which relates to the holding by the Court of Appeals that the party's marriage is voidable. This apparently comes about from an interpretation of the requirements of Virginia Code Section 20-13. In our view, the facts in this case show that all the requirements of Virginia Code Section 20-13 were in fact met by the parties to this marriage. The facts indicate that the parties to the marriage were conducting a marriage in their home. They had employed an official, a rabbi, who came to the home to conduct a ceremony before some 70 house guests. During the course of getting ready for the wedding, the rabbi and the parties discovered that there was no marriage license. The parties indicated they didn't know that they had to get one before the ceremony. They conferred with the rabbi before any ceremony began, and in that conference, the rabbi indicated to them that they should get the license as soon as they could after the ceremony was completed, and then they should send the license to him, and then he would sign it. Now, there's more. When the rabbi testified in his deposition in this case, he was asked about this process. He explained that he had never conducted a Virginia wedding before, but that he looked at it as a process. In other words, that every element of what I've described to you was something that he believed began with the ceremony in December of 2002, on the 21st day of that month, and then ended on January 21st, of 2003, when he received the license from the parties.
So the solemnization chapter of the story was not limited to the ceremony. It extended until the agreed terminus date of that chapter.
Yes, Justice Kelsey. And you might say that while every ceremony may involve solemnization, not every solemnization needs to involve a ceremony. What we have here is an ode.
Well, you don't have to go that far because you had a ceremony.
Exactly. There was a ceremony, and we don't say that it lacked significance. In fact, during the course of that ceremony, he certainly heard the parties express their intention to be married. And then, by prearrangement, when he received the license from the parties, he knew that that intention continued. And he so testified that that was his assumption, or they wouldn't be sending it to him. And of course, it's very important in this case.
Counsel.
Yes.
Let me change the facts ever so slightly.
Yes.
Just hypothetical. He performs the ceremony. A day or two later, there is a real estate transaction which indicates that it's tenants by the entire lease. That the deed is signed, delivered, entered of record, and then subsequently the marriage certificate is signed.
Yes.
What happens with my real estate?
Well, that's not this case.
I understand that. But I can almost promise you that at some point we will deal with that case based upon how we decide this case.
I think that since they couldn't hold titles tenants by the entirety, the result would more likely be that it would be viewed as tenants in common.
Okay. And under those circumstances, would that in any way affect title? Would that affect title insurance being provided? Would that introduce uncertainty into our real estate law that otherwise would not be there?
I think it's a different area of the law, and it would be a different reason for analysis.
Would a title insurance company need to ask to see the marriage certificate each time under those circumstances?
Well, the title insurance company would presumably go to the marriage register. And in this particular case, the marriage register indicated that the parties were married on January 21 of 2003. The court may recall that the rabbi, when he was questioned during his deposition, indicated that he did not attempt to make the marriage retroactive to the date of the ceremony. He made the marriage effective as of the date that he received the certificate because he viewed that as the completion of the process. And I think that answers Your Honor's question.
Okay, let me ask another question. What if the certificate wasn't entered of record until 1 year after the ceremony rather than 1 month? Or 10 years? Or whatever amount of time you want to...
That could happen in any marriage.
Or in any purported marriage.
Yes, in other words, it's possible that an officiant might not do his duty and return the marriage license filled out to the clerk's office in time.
But your point is that as soon as the marriage license is ultimately executed, that's when the marriage legally begins.
Correct.
And what if it is not executed for a year?
Well, that would not be this case.
I understand that.
Well, we get into other questions that aren't present here. For example, the marriage license is good for 60 days. I'm not sure whether that means that the officiant has to sign it within 60 days. I don't know, for example, if there would be an excuse for the officiant not to sign it. He had a heart attack. He went into a coma after an automobile accident, something of that nature, and the parties were completely unaware that he hadn't returned it to the clerk's office in time. I mean, we could speculate endlessly about things that are not within the orbit of the facts of this case. But in this particular case, we're saying, why isn't this a valid marriage under these circumstances?
Counsel, as you well know, we are required to speculate.
We are not only
deciding this case, we are deciding the law from this day until the end of time.
It is possible, though, for this court to say on the facts in this case, this result obtains.
Well, in your case,
you have to distinguish every other case thereafter.
Well, it's easily distinguishable unless the facts are the same.
Which is why we always ask these questions, either in our own minds or during oral argument, because sometimes they are distinguishable, sometimes they're not distinguishable based upon the facts in the law.
I would certainly agree with that, Justice Mims. It's my profession to make sure that we are able to distinguish or not distinguish those things.
That's why we wrestle with these.
That's all I know.
So to frame your argument, if I'm understanding it correctly, and as has been pointed out, you need to clarify all the implications of everything you say, obviously.
Oh, yes.
But the threshold moment is the moment of executing the license, because we don't have common law marriage in Virginia. So your license was entered on a certain day. The officiant dated the marriage as of that day, as opposed to a year earlier or 3 weeks earlier. And the only question is not, is it a lawful marriage after the execution of the license, but is the license somehow rendered nugatory because the ceremony had taken place earlier and the end of the solemnization phase ended before the execution of the license. So I'm thinking through all the hypotheticals.
I'm sorry, just Kelsey, on what you're saying, the end of these the solemnization phase.
Yeah, as I understand your theory, the solemnization phase went all the way up until the moment of executing the license. So essentially it was a simultaneous event. The last coda of the solemnization phase ended at the signing by the rabbi of the marriage, and the rabbi correctly dated it that day as opposed to the formal ceremony.
Yes, may I give you an analogy? Mm-hmm. It may not be a perfect analogy. If someone goes to a track meet and they hear a gun go off, and they've never been to a track meet before, and they've never been acquainted with the rules, they might look around and say, why is someone shooting a gun? But if they've been to track meets and they know what the rules are, they know that the signaling of the gun is a nonverbal form of communication, start running. That's similar to what the parties did here. In this particular circumstance, they sat down and they agreed on an entire process for the solemnization, even before the ceremony took place. I think it's highly significant that they weren't trying to fix something that had already been done. In other words, we've had the ceremony. They said, okay, now where's the license? Oh, well, we'll do it this way. Instead, A to Z, it was planned what the indication would be to the celebrant of their intention to be married. And I think that leads to what the fundamental issue is in the case, and that is, We are dealing here with a private contract of marriage between individuals. That's not been changed by our statutory scheme. The purpose of our statutory scheme, and Bishop writes all kinds of things on this.
Isn't it the license that authorizes the ceremony to take place?
Yes.
And so if I don't have the license, what authorized the ceremony?
Well, it's not an authorization for the ceremony to take place. It's an authorization to be married.
But it is also an authorization for the solemnization of the marriage. And so you have to, it seems to me that it's anticipated that you have to have the license, as you would have to have a driver's license before you drive. I think someone's brief said a fishing license before you fish. Why isn't the issuance of the license a necessary predicate to the ceremony taking place?
We would have two responses to that. First of all, you don't have to have a driver's license to take the driver's test. That's an element of getting a driver's license. An element of becoming married under the statute is that there be a license.
Taking the driver's test doesn't authorize you to drive until you have the license.
I agree with Your Honor. But I'm also saying that there are only two things that are required under the statute, that there be a marriage license, and secondly, that there be a solemnization. So that gets us into the question of what is the solemnization in the case, and whether we're really arguing over whether there was enough solemnization in this case, which is something that I don't think the court wants to get into.
I'm not questioning the method, the amount, anything about how the solemnization took place. I'm really concerned that it seems to me if you have a solemnization without the license that authorizes it, what do you have?
Well, again, our view of it is that the license is a license to marry, and then the elements have to be completed for there to be a valid marriage, and we say that those elements were completed. There were two parts. A license was obtained. And secondly, there was a solemnization process that was agreed to by the parties and the official.
The license is a license to marry, and there are two elements, the solemnization and the license.
I agree.
Well, I don't agree. I'm trying to understand what you're saying. The license is a license to marry with two elements, and you're making the license an element of the license by saying there are two elements.
Well, the license isn't necessary for every aspect of the solemnization as planned by the parties to be carried out. It just has to be that the officiant must be able to certify, as the officiant did in this case, that the party's private contract of marriage was entered into. And I think that that's what takes us back into the history of these statutes. For example, what we're really interested in here in the Commonwealth of Virginia, if you look at Oldfield, it's very clear on this. If you look at Bishop, it's very clear on this, is that we want a permanent witness to this marriage. In other words, part of the mischief that we had to live with previously when people could marry themselves under the common law was that later on there would be a contest as to whether this marriage actually took place. And so this procedure that we have is really to provide a permanent witness to the private contract of marriage between parties. You know, Bishop says that marriage is a natural right that preexisted all statutes. And he goes on in detail in his treatise to explain why all these little formalities and technicalities have traditionally held not to be enough to defeat a marriage between two persons because of the superior natural right. Now, we have circumstances where we're not going to recognize that because we don't want common law marriages. But the reason we don't want common law marriages is because we then have to either go out and find the witnesses or other proof, and it leads to all kinds of dispute. So by having a statutory scheme of this nature, we create the permanent witness to this marriage that everyone can consult.
And interestingly, we don't define solemnization statutorily or by case law or in any way. Solemnization can take place pretty much at the election of the participants.
Actually, that's true. I don't think anyone can glean from 20-13 precisely what solemnization means. So,
but isn't the whole question not whether or not there ought to be a solemnization, but when it has to occur? It's the timing of it.
Well, the solemnization in this case occurred at the moment when by prearrangement the officiant received the license. I see that my time is up in terms of what I wish to preserve for rebuttal. I'm not abandoning any assignments of error simply because of I haven't had time to address them. Thank you.
You have 1 second for rebuttal.
1 second.
Yeah. But apparently you all have another case coming up, so I suspect you'll be able to say anything you want.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Edna Ruth Vincent, and I represent Levick as the appellant in McDougall versus Levick, and I represent him as the appellee in Levick versus McDougall, and the appellee in the consolidated case of McDougall versus Levick. And I'm here with my co-counsel, Mary Hoff. This is, in fact, a case that is a solemnization without a license, then a license and no solemnization. The union in this case, this attempted union, was never solemnized. It's true that the statute nor the cases define specifically what is required for solemnization, but the Court of Appeals has said in an unpublished opinion that at the very minimum, both parties should be present in front of the officiant.
Well, that was actually an opinion that I wrote, and the statement in context means the ceremony requires their presence, even though there's contrary authority from the Attorney General's office on this. But solemnization is a larger phase. And tell me, if I'm understanding your position would be if you go to a marriage ceremony and you leave the church, and as they're walking out the church to the car to go on the honeymoon, the pastor or the rabbi or the priest or whomever runs out and says, "Oh, I forgot something. Where's your license?" And "Here it is. Thank you, Rabbi." He signs the license. And they go off to Aruba, and they're married for 30 years. Would they be married under your analysis?
I'm not sure I followed that.
Okay, you have a ceremony, a wedding ceremony, and it's over. Everyone leaves the church or the synagogue or whatever. It's over. There's no pre-arrangement either, as is this unique case. And the rabbi runs out to the car as they're getting ready to drive off on the honeymoon and says, "I forgot to sign the darn license. Do you have it?" "Yes." "Okay, thank you." And he signs it. And it happens 10 minutes after the ceremony. It's clearly, by everyone's concession, over. Would that marriage, after 30 years, be unlawful?
If that officiant is licensed to perform the ceremony, to perform the solemnization, and at the time that the officiant, the rabbi, went to the car, both parties were there, and he was able to determine whether it was through one word, "Yes," or three words, "We want you to do it," that's four words, I think they would be married, because what they're demonstrating is mutual assent.
So taking it from 10 minutes to 30 minutes, he tracks them down at the International House of Pancakes while they're getting a bite on the way out, and "We forgot to sign this." Your analysis at that point is going to give out, because it's going to very closely...
Well, the point that I'm making is solemnization, it doesn't matter what kind of ceremony, it doesn't matter what you wear, it doesn't matter what you say. What is important is that this is a contract of marriage. You're entering into a legal marital contract that the state wants to regulate.
But counsel, is the issue when the license was signed or when the license was issued? The code anticipates the license will be issued before the ceremony takes place, and then after the ceremony takes place, the license is signed.
What is at issue is that what the parties did on December 21st, 2002 was have a ceremony, and that created no marriage at all. It was just a ceremony because they did not have a license to be married.
But they're not claiming it did create a marriage. the rabbi's execution of the license several weeks later is the date they claim the marriage legally began.
But that's the problem. They are telling this, arguing that solemnization can be with by mail, that it can be a continuation from an event that wasn't licensed to create a lawful marriage in Virginia. And our position is that is absolutely not the case. That once you have the license, it is from that January 21st, 2003 that they obtained the license. They needed to do something to communicate to the rabbi that they wanted to be married. They had a present intent, not a past intent that was a month before, but we have a license now. And what the rabbi has to do and what the license requires is that the officiant attest to the matters of the marriage.
But their whole argument is exactly what you just said.
I'm sorry?
Their whole argument is, right, and we pre-agreed to do exactly this. That's their argument. Their argument is they didn't forget it, they forgot about it and did it later, but we sat down with the celebrant and the officiating celebrant and we agreed on a process of solemnization, and at the end of the process you're going to sign the license and we're going to have our, we've got everyone here now, we're going to have our
Well, I would say that the facts which were resolved in Mr. Levick's favor do not reflect that, and there's been no error assigned to the facts. What the rabbi said is, I assume that the parties hadn't changed their mind. I thought it was a safe bet. But here's the problem. On the day that the rabbi signed the marriage certificate, he didn't know if one of the parties had died. He didn't know if one of the parties together had a big argument and decided we don't want to be married anymore. He knew no circumstances other than relating back to a time when there was no marriage at all. We're saying there has to be a present intent and assent that can be, that is presented to the officiant. This rabbi falsified the marriage certificate, said he married the parties on the day that he signed the certificate, January 21, 2003, and said that the ceremony took place in Virginia. Well, that was untrue. They, at no time from the time the parties got the license until the rabbi signed it, had any contact of any nature. An assistant from Mr. Levick's office FedExed it to the rabbi. So within that period of time, which is absolutely significant, that's when the rabbi had the authority to marry the parties, to solemnize something.
It's a bit of an extreme charge to charge him with falsifying it, because under their construct of what happened, it makes perfect sense to have used the date that they used. In fact, under their construct, the falsification implication would be if they backdated it to the physical ceremony, as happened in the case that you mentioned earlier, the unpublished opinion from the Court of Appeals.
Well, but what he says is that he married them on a date when he had actually not been in their presence and affirm that they wanted to be married to each other on that day. And he did not, and the license authorized him to marry them in Virginia. He wasn't in Virginia. When he attempted to marry them in Virginia, there was no license. So how can you relate back no license as if there's a continuum process for marriage solemnization? And there's absolutely nothing in the case law or in the statutes, if you read, or even around the statutes, there's nothing that would give any indication that, and I think the Court of Appeals was absolutely right, that it is a sequence. The mandatory statute, 2013, says obtain a license, marry. The Court of Appeals clarified that license first, solemnization second, and there was no error assigned to that. So the order is important. A license is a prerequisite to do something. It's what enables you to perform the act. Getting the license after the fact, FedExing it, is, I mean, can we create marriage by FedEx? There's no way the rabbi could have known if, in fact, or could have sworn truthfully that he married those parties on that day. The union that they attempted was void ab initio. The mandatory requirements of 2013 have to be adhered to. The Oakville case has been the law in its interpretation and construing of the Virginia statute, the requirement that all marriages in Virginia have to be under license, and if they are not under license, they are not valid.
Can I ask you one more question? Even older than Oldfield is the presumption, that one of the strongest presumptions known to law, that in doubtful cases, the integrity of marriage should be recognized, particularly when we're it involves doubtful technicalities. Now, if there is such a thumb on the scale, and it is that strong, and no one can provide any direct authority saying that this kind of solemnization agreement cannot be made, why doesn't the presumption hold and the rebuttal case fail?
If this were a technicality, maybe the presumption would. But this isn't a technicality. This isn't one of authority in the officiant. This isn't some discrepancy in the marriage license. This is a blatant, I have no license. And what you're being asked to do is to take the wrecking ball to 2013, take the wrecking ball to Oldfield and its progeny of cases that have set forth that you have to have the license first. The contract of marriage is an equally compelling state interest. The marriage creation, the process, the ability to regulate it for the purpose of precluding common law marriage in Virginia. And what we have in this case is tremendous ambiguity that will, you know, what we're asking the court to do is to affirm the Court of Appeals, but to reverse just on a single issue, and that's the issue of void versus voidability. Our contention, and we think the case law supports it, is that no union was ever created between these parties. And the fact that you may want to say there was a marriage, or the fairness might make you want to create a marriage, but equity, you can't create a lawful marriage with equity. There was no union created. And there was not one that could be cured by the curative statute. One of the cases that is cited, is a case where the parties had a marriage license, Virginia marriage license, and went to D.C. and had a Hindu marriage ceremony. It's Chatahari. Went to D.C., had a Hindu marriage ceremony, came back to Virginia, and then just went to the officiant's house with no fanfare, no ceremony, went to the officiant's house and said to the officiant in Virginia, "We want to be married. Will you sign the certificate?" That case is cited by Ms. McDougall as evidence that there's this continuum process, but the contrary is true. What the court said in that case is, it was a valid marriage. The reason it was a valid marriage is because they had a Virginia license, they went to a Virginia officiant, he got observed, both of them giving their mutual assent to to enter into this marriage contract and sign the certificate, and it was a valid marriage. That's not what we have here, and there's not a single case that we found where a 2013 non-compliant marriage has created a valid marriage. It just, in fact, does not create a valid marriage. It creates a nullity. And it's a nullity that doesn't get evaluated under Chapter 3 of Title 20. All the cases that are evaluated under prohibited marriages are unions that were first solemnized and under license. Everybody's gotten it right since Oldfield. Oldfield was a first impression case. This is first impression because the laws really are simple.
All right, your time has expired. The clerk will formally call the next case.